back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone for the first part of the show is Walt Meyer. He's a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado, and he's here to talk about, well, Arctic sea ice. Walt joins us periodically to give us some updates on how things are going up in the Arctic. And Walt, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me again. Nice to talk with you again.
Well, let's start here. Arctic sea ice. How is Arctic sea ice measured?
So we measure it primarily through, we measure the extent of it through what's called passive microwave remote sensing satellite data, measuring energy coming from the surface in microwave energy. That allows us to see at night and see through clouds, which is really important in the Arctic region. It gives us complete daily coverage. So we have a record now going back to 1979 of the sea ice pretty much every day.
Okay. So what's interesting is that when I see charts and graphs measuring the sea ice on your website, it says 15% coverage. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's our definition of what we call sea ice extent. So we're basically drawing a line around all regions where there's at least 15% sea ice and counting that as ice covered. And that's been around for a long time. It's a convention, and it depends. It partly comes from the satellite sensor characteristics itself in terms of how sensitive it is at the ice edge to get a good kind of general total extent in terms of total area covered by ice. One could pick other numbers, 30%. Some people have done that. It just kind of shifts things one way or the other. It doesn't really change the trends or the overall changes. No. It's just the convention that's used.
Right. So that's interesting because you could effectively have a aerial area of water that's 85% surface water, but it would be count as ice covered under that definition.
Right. Yeah. So it includes, you know, areas, potentially includes areas that are pretty sparse. But the thing with sea ice is that you can have situations like that, but typically the ice is either, you know, well above 15% or it's pretty much open water. In the fall it grows and grows quite quickly once things cool down, and so it doesn't stay below 15% for long. And likewise in the spring and summer when it's melting, as it gets to that low of a concentration, there's so much water and so much heat around that it melts away pretty quickly. So it does, you know, affect a little bit, but it's a pretty minor change. You know, it's been looked at, and it really doesn't make much difference what thresholds you use.
So so the maximum sea ice extent occurs when, and when does the minimum extent occur?
So the maximum typically occurs in March. It varies quite a bit from year to year. It depends a lot on the local weather. The ice is pretty far south, so it really depends on, you know, the weather there and how it pushes the ice out or pushes it in. This last year in March, it was March 5th, which is about a week earlier than normal. But we've had it from as early as, you know, kind of the last few days of February and even into the first day or two of April. So it's quite variable. The minimum occurs in September. It's always occurred in September sometime. Hmm. It's not quite as variable, but it still varies between the beginning of September to roughly about the third week of September, with the average being about September 12th. But again, that depends on the weather to some extent as well, as to when exactly you hit that minimum.
So we've just passed the maximum this year. What did it look like? How did it compare?
So this year was, I would say, pretty uneventful in a lot of ways. The last few years have been quite low, among the lowest we've had. And this year was only the 11th lowest out of 41 years. So it's still much lower than normal. But it's actually the highest we saw since 2013. So it's a little bit up. This kind of reflects, you know, the variability we see. You're going to have some years are relatively higher than others. The trend overall is still downward. And this year, a big cause of the kind of near normal was that the Bering Sea, which is the sea off the southwest coast of Alaska, you know, beneath Alaska and eastern Siberia, that the last 2 years have been record low for most of the winter, and often for those last two winters, almost ice free for much of that. Whereas this year, the Bering Sea was pretty much completely ice covered, you know, as normal. It grew during December, and we actually had more ice than average a little bit at the beginning of March, which is, you know, when we reached the maximum. So that really kind of contributed to making things not as low as in the past few years. Now, an interesting thing there is that things changed pretty rapidly after that. Right after that maximum, by the middle of March, we were seeing the ice disappear very quickly in the Bering Sea, one of the fastest meltouts in the Bering Sea that we've seen. And by the end of the month, it was much lower than normal, and that kind of drove the overall extent to being quite a bit lower. We were, by the end of the month, fourth or fifth lowest extent, coming down from 11th lowest maximum. So so things have changed quite a bit very quickly, but overall, in terms of the maximum, it was a fairly uneventful winter, I would say.
And how many years has record-keeping been observed?
So our best quality satellite data, like I said, that goes back to 1979. It started actually late 1978, and we got our first full year in 1979, our first sea ice maximum and minimum in 1979. There were some satellite data before going all the way back into the 1960s, but it was pretty scattered and sparse. We didn't have complete records. We didn't have data every day, every month, and it also is hard to connect to that 1979 forward record, and so we generally don't include that. Although, you know, we can look at that and see that, you know, that downward trend does kind of extend back into that. There are some scattered data. There was a lot of ice charting groups. We have what's called the U.S. National Ice Center, which is in the Washington D.C. area, and they have been tracking ice for ships and for, you know, submarines and so forth way back into the 50s. And some groups in Canada and in Denmark have gone back even into the 1920s. So there is some scattered data. We do have actually a data set that was put together by some colleagues that goes all the way back to about 1900. And, you know, that gives us a really long record. Again, as you get earlier, it gets a little sketchier. You know, there's less sources. It goes down to ship observations that, you know, meet the ice edge, or in later years, some aircraft observations, and then the very early satellites. So our data have progressively gotten better. And so that earlier data isn't totally complete. We've had some people have looked at that, completing it with model data, you know, using the observations that we have and then augmenting it with models with the atmospheric data that we have. And so, you know, we have some indication. It's not as good as what we've got since 1979. But one thing it shows is that, you know, there's been ups and downs over the decades, but what we're seeing in these last four decades is outside of anything we saw in the previous century, for sure.
So there's another piece to this data, which is not just the extent of the ice, but also the depth of the ice. So tell us a little bit about how that's changing, and how are you able to measure that? That seems like it might be more difficult than satellite imaging.
Right. It's definitely more difficult, and we don't have near as good of data on that. Our data really started with submarines, actually, that cruising under the Arctic ice, and they have sonar, which pings out, you know, a lot of that. A major reason for that is to ping enemy submarines to find out where they may be. But if you're in the Arctic, you have the ice, and it can vary in thickness, and it can actually get piled up into these ridges and keels that you know, that underneath the ice go down many feet, 30, 40 feet 50 feet, even sometimes 100 feet, potentially underneath the surface. So if you're in a submarine under the Arctic, you don't want to hit one of those. So they have actually upward-looking sonar that pings off of that. So there's data that goes back actually a little bit into the 1950s when they first started sailing under the Arctic with submarines. But most of it comes from the 1970s. And then some in the 1990s. A lot of this data was classified for many, many years, for obvious reasons, but it has been declassified. And so we have some data from the 1970s and 1990s that give us a decent picture, at least in parts of the Arctic. And then we've got satellite data, but it's a different type of satellite data than what we use for measuring the extent. It's what's called an altimeter. And it's basically measuring the height. It's sending a signal down from the satellite. It bounces off the surface and then bounces back to the satellite. And how fast, we know that that signal is going at the speed of light. And so, and we basically can time when it gets sent out and when it comes back. And using that, we can tell the distance. And that can tell us the height of the ice. So that's the height above the surface. And if we know a little bit or can estimate a little bit about what the density of the ice is, then that can tell us how much is below the water, which gives us the total thickness. So there's a European satellite that uses a radar called Cryosat that was launched in 2010. Before that, there was a laser satellite called ICESat, which is a NASA satellite called Ice Cloud and Land Elevation Satellite that uses lasers, again, bouncing it down and getting it back. And then now, in 2018, NASA launched a follow-on called ICESat-2, and that's getting us really great data. We're archiving that data at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, far more data on thickness than what we've had to date. So our data is getting better and better. Just like the extent data, it's getting better and better, but our extent data started from the 1900s. We're really starting from the 1970s in terms of thickness. So we don't have long of a record, but it's getting better. And one thing that it's clearly showing is that the ice is not only shrinking in terms of how much surface area is covered, but it's getting thinner. We've lost, since the 1970s, roughly 50% of the thickness of the ice on average.
Wow.
And that's a big change. So we're, it may look similar, on top of the ice, like this March was only 11th lowest, in terms of the maximum, but it's a thinner ice cover than what we'd seen back in the 80s and even into the early 1990s.
Let me reintroduce you. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Walt Meyer. He's a senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of at the University of Boulder, Colorado, in Boulder, of course. So continuing that thought about thickness, it's usually measured also in age. In a sense, this is 1 year old ice, two, three, four. And I saw a chart on your website that suggests that ice that is 4 years and older is ostensibly disappearing.
Correct, yeah. So one of the things that, because we didn't have great thickness data, we can track the ice age. We do this actually by tracking the ice as it moves around the Arctic and keeping track of how long it's been there since it formed. And ice that, it grows through the winter, it will melt during the summer. If it survives the summer, then it grows again. And typically, it will grow thicker during the winter, during the winters, and it melts during the summer if it survives. And so older ice is generally thicker ice. And so as you get to, ice that just grows through one winter, it will get to maybe about 6 feet thick, six and a half feet thick. That's about as much as it can grow, even in a really cold winter. But as you go through several winters, it gets thicker and thicker. And by the time you get to about 4 years old, you're getting into ice that's about 10 to 12 feet thick, and even a little bit thicker maybe. So, that four-year-old ice is about twice as thick as the what we call the first-year ice, the ice that's just survived or just formed over the one winter. And we've tracked that, and again, we have that data at the National Snow and Ice Data Center as well, and we've tracked that since about the 1984 is when we really can start getting data on that for the older ice. And again, it used to be, you know, 30%, 30 to 35% of the Arctic Ocean was covered by that thick old ice, that 4-plus-year-old ice that's, mm-hmm. you know, 12 feet thick. That's gone down to like a percent, 1% or less. So it's virtually disappeared. There's ice that's a little bit younger that's, you know, maybe, you know, 7 or 8 feet thick, you know, for example. But we've really lost that thick old ice cover.
So Chris and I are staring at each other saying, did we hear you right? Did you say 1% or less?
Yeah, our data actually shows it as being, I think it was 0.9%. Last year was 0.9%. This year it went up a little bit. I think it's about 1.5%, 1.4%. So there's a little bit of that three-year-old ice that survived and kind of aged into, had its birthday and aged into four-year-old ice. But, yeah, we've gone from, you know, roughly 30 to 35% to about 1%, which is, you know, almost negligible.
Right, almost probably within error. Margin of error.
Right. Okay. There's probably still some there, but, it's virtually gone.
So that thicker ice can also be used to kind of study past, like, climate, right? So is this a sort of a record of our past that we're losing by losing this older ice?
Well, to some extent, it's true. I mean, you can drill cores. The ice always, with the ice, it's always in motion. It's moving around the Arctic, and generally, it circulates out of the Arctic due to the ice motion. So we don't see much ice outside of 10 years old in general. What used to happen is it would circulate around, it would get over 4 years old, sit around, and you'd have this kind of continuous replenishment. But eventually it does go out. So we don't get really long records from these. There are some areas that are protected for sea ice where it kind of sits there and can get thicker. But most of our, like the ice, when people talk about long-term climate records from ice, you're talking more about the ice sheets like Greenland and Antarctica, where things pile up for thousands and even hundreds of thousands of years, and you can get really long climate records from those.
So along those lines, let's talk about why this ice is melting. Obviously, air temperature is one cause. And from the website, I read that for April's air temps averaged 4 to 9 degrees above average. So that's one cause of melting. But another cause is ocean temperatures, because the ice is melting from below. So which one is having a greater impact?
I think that's a good question, and I think it's still somewhat of an open question. We can see the air temperatures. We've got pretty good records on those. That's relatively easy to get. Ocean temperatures is more difficult in terms of the Arctic, because you don't know exactly. It's hard to get temperatures. You know, it's hard enough to get thickness of the ice from, like, satellites, but you can't really get the temperature of the water underneath the ice. Mm-hmm. We have more buoys that get temperature as, like, for example, ice as water or ice flows in through the Bering Strait. There are some also in northern Europe. And we have definitely seen increases in ocean temperatures. How much that is actually reaching the ice, one of the things is that the warmer temperatures, especially on the Atlantic side, because of density gradients, the warmer temperatures tend to go underneath, and there's a what's called a halo cline, or a layer that's cold and fresh that keeps the warmer and saltier water underneath. But there is some connection, there is some overturning there, and heat is getting up there, but we're not sure how much. And we're not sure how much is getting in from the Pacific side. Water, the heat, warm water melts ice much more efficiently than warm air does. Even a couple degrees above freezing can melt a lot of ice, whereas air temperatures, it's less efficient. So the ocean waters are definitely a concern, but we don't have as good of data. We don't know exactly how much is hitting the ice. So that's an area that's still an open question and an area of active research that's going on as we speak.
But again, I mean, and confirm this, because I got this off the website too, the NSIDC dot, it's gov, right?
We're actually .org.
Oh, NSIDC.
Yeah, we're not officially.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
I read that the loss of April ice, you know, April over April, comparing one April to the next over the last 40 years, the average loss of ice has been about 15,000 square miles per year?
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't have the number off the top of my head here, but that's, if you got it off the website, that should be correct. Yeah, so we're losing ice, you know, in the Arctic year round. I mean, September gets a lot of the press and a lot of attention because that's the minimum. That's a good climate indicator. That's where you get the lowest of the low. But every month is losing ice. So we're losing ice all months of the year. The trends vary a little bit from month to month. You know, winters are less extreme compared to summers, but it's still a significant ice loss in months like March and April, et cetera.
Wow. Now, you said that the minimum will occur sometime around early September. There's always that lag between the hottest part of the year and how, you know, its impacts show up. A listener texted in, how close can you now sail to the North Pole? And when do you think we might be able to, when there might be open water at the North Pole?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it varies from year to year. You know, it's not only the total extent, but also where the ice is varies. We've had some years where you could get within, I'd say, about 200 miles of the pole. In 2007, it got quite close. I think 2016 and 2012 as well. We're around that distance, so not too far. When it actually is going to open up, you know, for the North Pole being ice-free, that's a good question. There's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, we know things are trending downward, and we know we're heading towards an ice-free Arctic as things continue to warm. And, you know, the North Pole will open up before we lose most of the ice. But the North Pole is fairly far. It's in the area where it's close to the area where we're going to lose the ice last. And part of that is because the ice tends to drift over from Russia towards Greenland and kind of crosses the pole, and then it kind of piles up over there. So it's thickest right along the coast of Greenland and the Canadian islands, and then it kind of thins from there. So the North Pole is still relatively thicker ice. Compared to over like Siberia or even the north coast of Alaska there. So it's a good question on how fast that's going to disappear. We're looking at, in terms of losing pretty much all of the ice in the Arctic, the best models that we have, best projections that we have are probably somewhere around 2050. The North Pole will be, you know, before then. But there's a lot of uncertainty just in terms of the variability from year to year that we just don't know what the weather's going to be. So any kind of prediction is probably going to be plus or minus 10 years, depending just on whether you get a series of warm years or a series of somewhat cooler years, and also which way the winds blow and which, you know, how the ice moves out of the Arctic as to whether, like, the North Pole will clear out early or late. So, you know, I don't think we're going to see it this year or the next few years, but 2030 is certainly possible, and maybe even before then, as far as the North Pole being having a year with the North Pole being essentially ice-free.
That's not far away.
Yeah, not far away at all.
We'll still be calling you, Walt.
For a quarterly update.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, that's one of the most stark changes, I think, that we've seen in terms of research. You know, 15 years ago, people were looking at maybe 2100. You might get to pretty low ice cover, you know, in September, but maybe even beyond that. And now we're looking at, you know, much earlier. You know, it used to be something that, you know, our grandchildren might live to see, and now it's like I might see this even before I retire, potentially, and I'm not that far away from retirement.
Yeah, well, you and a lot of other people we've talked to who track other types of things going on in nature, all with, you know, we're saying maybe 10 years ago this will happen at the end of this century, and now it seems, well, maybe by the middle of this century or sooner. So there are a lot of indicators that are moving up on their schedule. So last couple minutes, got to talk about, obviously you're working at home as well as I'm assuming you're working from home and other staff are. How has the virus or the pandemic impacted any ongoing research projects?
So for me, personally and generally at NSIDC, it hasn't impacted us yet. All our data, or I shouldn't say all of our data, but most of our data is satellite. It collects, we can work from home, work remotely very easily. I do have some research colleagues who are having field work upended because of travel. And one significant one that's been in the news, it's called this MOSAIC, which is Multidisciplinary Drifting Observatory for the Study of Arctic Climate. That's actually an icebreaker that's been frozen into the Arctic. It was frozen in last October with the idea of staying there for a full year and collecting data as it drifts across the Arctic. I have several colleagues there that have been up there, and you can't stay up all winter. It's just too long of a time, and they need to resupply the ship anyway. So they've been doing regular shifts of people every 6 weeks or so, but that's been upended because they don't want to have anyone go into the ship that is positive, because they're a long way from any help if people start getting sick up there, and they don't have, they have some medical help, but not near the facility. So they've been taking extreme precautions. They've cut it back on the number of people going up there. There's a crew going up there fairly soon, a relief crew, but they're going to have to, they're isolating, and they're actually having to do some, unfortunately, they're having to pull the ship out of the Arctic to come down to meet so they can do a transfer more easily. And then head back up. So it's upended that. It's upended other field work, and depending on how things go, summer field work like in Alaska. I have a colleague that works on permafrost and frozen ground in Alaska and goes up there in the summer, and it's unsure whether things are going to go forward at this point. So it definitely upends field work. For me personally and for our satellite data, it's business as usual.
Walt Meyer. He's a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado. Again, the website is nsidc.org. It's got great charts and graphs, and it's updated almost on a weekly basis. So thanks for continuing to do that, Walt. We always appreciate chatting with you. And
sure.
We will touch base with you in September.
All right. Look forward to it. Always nice talking to you. Thanks.
All right.